Today is June the 12th, 2019. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, and Amazon are using your personal data? You should know. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the programs available on prn.fm, on the Internet, and pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, the phone number is 641-793-7091. You can leave us a message with your question or comment to hank@pcradioshow.org. You can also reach us on the Google number 862-800-6805. Start your message with The Personal Computer Show, followed by your message. Google is getting heat from the federal government and also from the state government of California. Bloomberg News and other news organizations reported last week that the U.S. Department of Justice is preparing to open an investigation into Google's compliance with antitrust laws. The U.S. Federal Trade Commission in 2013 closed without further action its own antitrust investigation into whether Google wielded its dominant web search engine like a cudgel to disadvantage rivals, driving up prices for advertisers, and ultimately harming consumers. Google did agree to some voluntary changes. In recent years, the European Union antitrust watchdog has imposed billions of dollars in fines after finding antitrust violations, including over how Google conducted business with its Android smartphone software and its internet shopping service. Antitrust investigations are difficult to predict, of course, and once the U.S. government pours over every internal email and business development contract, there's no telling what will turn up. If the DOJ moves ahead, it will also be an open invitation for every company or individual with a gripe against Google to pile on. An investigation will also embolden critics of Facebook and Amazon and other tech giants as well. It's worth remembering that Google narrowly escaped a possible antitrust lawsuit the last time the U.S. looked closely. Portions of communications between the FTC commissioners and staff later showed that staffers wanted to bring an antitrust lawsuit on a few matters, including on what they said was Google's strong-arm tactics to scrape information from websites such as Yelp and TripAdvisor without their permission to improve Google's search engine. Ultimately, the FTC commissioners unanimously voted not to pursue a lawsuit and possibly a breakup of what was then a smaller Google. That was a different time then. With the current administration, the White House is openly critical of Google unfairly suppress conservative voices online. But this is not the only thing dogging Google. With more contractors than employees, Google risks massive lawsuit under California law. Google works hard to keep the 121,000 contractors it employs separate from its permanent employees. The two groups wear different color badges, and contractors are barred from some meetings, and they aren't provided employee perks such as health insurance and vacation time. The company apparently put these measures in place to make the status of its contractors as non-employees legally clear. Even so, it's still risking a major labor lawsuit in Google's home state of California. Last December, the contractors at Google sent an open letter to the CEO, Sundar Pichai, demanding the same benefits as full-time employees and also to be included in companies' communications and meetings. These temps, vendors, and contractors make up more than half the company's workforce. Google employs about 102,000 full-time employees worldwide, and this is less than 121,000 contractors. And this was according to a recent New York Times report. These contractors are employed through a temp service or outsourcing company, meaning that Google does not employ them directly, giving yet Google another layer of legal protection, trying to skirt the law. Benjamin Rockwell will be talking about software as a service, pros and cons.
This week, I'm going into another deep dive into software as a service because it's a big thing. We're talking about it on a regular basis. We're starting to utilize it in areas that we're not aware that we're doing this. And I wanted to give you a little bit more of an unveiling of the man behind the curtain. See, software as a service sounds cool in some regards. And because of that, I want to drill down just a little bit more about some of the implications for all of us as we explore where it's going, what it's doing, and as we start to use it at home, at the office, and so forth. Now, there are clear advantages. Anytime we put together anything like this, there are advantages and disadvantages. And I'm going to give you some advantages. Yes, there are areas where our expenditures, whether it's at home or at the office, they're predictable. You pay one flat fee every month, every year, whatever it is, and your software and all of the different details behind it is delivered. There are no variable items. You don't have to call out additional technicians. You don't have to replace any hardware. There's no special needs during expansion and more. There's nothing like that. It's just that $1 amount every month regularly. Now, that does mean that you and your company get to focus on your business. Now, you may have local IT for some of the other needs, but the burden of support for some of the major packages is alleviated, and you get to work using the same methods that everyone else does around the world. There is also less initial investment. If you're at a company, they don't need to make a large investment in servers and hardware and a server room. The operating systems that all of the software pile on there and all of the different additional features. And they don't have to develop a software that is going to be the key software needed to run everything in-house. And this actually is a very hard driver for what we see in the office today, why everybody's so excited about software as a service. Now, there is also a lot of different functionality where you only pay every month or every year, again, for whatever you need. If you need this feature, it's added in. It's just another little piece of the pie. And they just keep adding it in. Whatever you need, it's turned on. Whatever you don't need, it's turned off. Anything else extra disappears. Maintenance of your servers, the maintenance of the databases, of the software, it's all handled by your provider. One computer also can handle multiple companies, so the expense of running this is shared across many customers. You also get immediate access to updates and new features. These arrive right away. So the greatest item ever, since sliced bread, the whole idea of that. Wow, I now get to do this so much faster. Nobody is required locally as an expert to install these features, so money is saved there. There are people who are thinking about how to implement these seamlessly, both forwards and backwards, so there's no breakage whenever we install a new feature. Bugs are also fixed faster. As the bug affects many customers and they send these little bug fixes out, they don't have to wait to build up a big, huge package to deliver these fixes. And then they build up that package, they send it out once a month, and your local IT guy, he then figures out whenever he's going to get to it, and that might be a matter of a month or two later. No, you can get a bug fixed right away. Now, the disadvantages. You are forced to do business the way that everybody else does this. I worked for a company many years ago that purchased a software package that would run the entire company, but it was built around making the same thing, the same widget, over and over and over and over and over and over again. Not what the company did. They were very unique in what they were doing in that they did completely customized items for every single customer. You could have any different number of options and sizes and more, and they did a number of different types of products. If you can't do things according to the way the external programmers want, and you dive into this software package, you're stuck. And it's worse than that because then you start feeling trapped as a customer. And this is whether or not this is all about doing business the way everyone else does this. Because you're stuck, because you've put all of your data onto somebody else's servers, you can't as easily move to a different provider or even bring it in-house because everything is on a custom platform controlled by someone else. They may not even provide services for export of data or linking to other systems and integration with a software package that you're already used to and you've used for years in-house. No, they want you to do it their way or not at all. And then what about this? There's a cost cuttings that are always happening, and this can lead to problems on the vendor side. What about speed of processing? Or there's an internet outage along the way, or someone else does something that affects your entire company. How often do we hear about Amazon outages, Facebook outages, and more? Do you shut your company down for the entire day? What if it's running slow for months, and the provider says, I don't see anything? You can't go anywhere else. And then what about data leaks? Oh, yeah. Who's responsible for that? Guess what? Your company takes the hit and has to explain to the customers and more, even though somebody else, the programming guys over at the external company, they made the mistake. Yeah. What happens if your company fails or the provider fails? Who owns the data then? See, data that is not located within your own company, within your own property, is scary and sometimes dangerous. Yeah. So there's some pros and cons along the way for this software as a service. You need to weigh those out very carefully. This is Benjamin Rockwell. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio. I'll be back with more in just a moment.
Thank you, Benjamin. The year was 1985. I was trying to schedule an on-air interview with Bill Gates. I had previously met with Bill, and we were to find some time to do it. And finally, one of his PR people called me if I could do it at the 4 Comdex meeting in Las Vegas the following week. I said, sure. I had to get some data recording equipment, so I got myself a Sony recorder. And of course, it's not the highest quality equipment back in the early 1980s. But it was useful. And the following was an interview with Bill where I asked him about computing yesterday, today, and tomorrow. And of course, the tomorrow refers to today.
We will now broadcast an interview with Bill Gates. Bill is the chairman of Microsoft Corporation, which is the largest independent software company in the United States. Bill was very gracious to spare time from his very busy schedule to share with us his views of yesterday, today, and tomorrow in personal computing. This interview was done on the patio of a hotel, and we had roaring airplanes and every conceivable noise there was, so the sound quality is not to our usual par, but I think the interview itself will speak for itself.
Since 1975, the personal computing industry has taken on explosive growth, and I consider you one of the leading pioneers, definitely, in the industry. But who else do you think have made a mark in the personal computing industry since that time?
Well, 1975 is 10 years ago, and some of the early pioneers aren't involved anymore, but MITS, that had the original Altair computer.
Ed Roberts.
Ed Roberts was the designer of that. Gary Kildall, who's the author of CPM, is still involved in the industry. He was a key person at the time.
He's back as chairman now.
Right. Actually, he's rejoined full-time digital research. Another key pioneer, a group of people at Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, although sometimes we don't think of them as directly associated with personal computers. It's really their ideas are some of the key things that are driving the innovations that have happened over the last 3 or 4 years. So people like Butler Lampson or Alan Kay, who were at the core of that group, doing research about the same time as PCs were getting going and doing things that we're only able to implement today.
They haven't received the notoriety yet.
No, and I don't know if they ever will. A lot of the people who were involved in those activities, like Charles Simony, who works for us, and a number of the people went on to Apple, like Larry Tesler, it's well known that, you know, they were there, and some people acknowledge it, but no, I think Xerox's contribution will never be fully appreciated?
Well, one of the things that we have in industry is what is called an XNS standard, which is a LAN standard, and it is Xerox standard.
Right. XNS and Ethernet are only two of the many, many things that came out of that research group.
Well, what kind of products do you feel has made a major impact since, in the past 10 years?
Well, the key that's fueling it all is the semiconductor industry is able to make better and better chips. And fortunately, that their almost magical capability to deliver more power at a constant price will continue at least for the next 10 years. So it's the, first the 8080 and then the 8086 and then the 8286 and the 8386 that are sort of at the heart of driving what's going on. And it's really only with that power and extra memory that things like graphic user interface or an operating system that runs multiple applications or these more ambitious applications that we run now, it's only with the power that this has come to make sense.
That's interesting. Is software designed after the hardware is built, or do you build a hardware with software in mind?
Well, in the sense that when you come out with the next generation personal computer, you put it out in the very competitive software industry and hope that people use it in ways that you hadn't expected. In that sense, the software comes afterwards. I mean, if you take any machine, whether it was the Apple II or the original 8-bit machines or now the IBM PC, the original designers didn't conceive of how far people would push those things and how much they would get out of it. But a lot of the inspiration for what are the key features to put into PCs come from software people, because they're the ones who are thinking about what benefits do we want to deliver to the end user. And so Microsoft in particular influenced the design of the 386, and we're now working with Intel on the chip that comes after the 386, and we play a pretty key role. Also, to get at the power of the hardware, you do need the key system software layers. And so those have to be there and designed essentially at the same time to think through what makes sense.
You think specific products like the Apple II and the IBM PC, their success is because they happened to be there at the right time, or the product itself made a difference?
Well, timing is very critical, because the value of a personal computer is really based on the software base that you build around it. And so they were positioned, well marketed, and they got momentum going that allowed them to build up a software base. And so there have been a number of other products that, just looking at the PC may have been superior, but those were the ones that really delivered a benefit with software. But all that aside, there were some key innovative features that came with the Apple II. It wasn't the first personal computer, but it was the first one to have bitmap graphics on the board. It was a very clever design, inexpensive to manufacture. The IBM PC was really the first 16-bit personal computer that let us go from machines that only supported 64K to now machines that support 640K, and even that's becoming a limitation for
right.
us.
We were talking about giants in the field. You seem to have left off Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak.
Oh, not intentionally. I mean, if I really wanted to do an exhaustive list, it would be very long. They belong very high on the list of great contributors, both because of the specific product and the vision they brought, and the way their company not only did the product, but also helped build up the marketing channels and got very serious about a business that initially was really addressing hobbyists, and so was missing a lot of the things that were necessary for the growth that we've had.
Where do we go from here? What products do you think will have major impacts over the next 5 years?
Well, our vision is that towards the end of that five-year period, most of the desktops will have a PC on them. And we believe that those PCs will be tied together. So networking is very, very important. And networking today is hard to set up, very expensive, and there's a lot of needs both on the hardware and software side there. We also believe that PC on every desktop will have a what we call graphic user interface, like the Macintosh provides, or like we're providing with Microsoft Windows. And so that means the need for faster graphics chips, opportunity to do full page displays so you can really see a lot of the document. We use electronic mail inside Microsoft as sort of the backbone of our communications. And the people who get large displays really don't want to give them up because, you know, it really increases the speed at which you can get information. Another key thing is this push towards faster processors. I mean, not everybody should buy an 8386 today because they're expensive and you know, the software isn't there yet that takes full advantage of them. But certainly 3 to 4 years from now, I think the mainstream PCs will be based on the 8386, and we'll already have machines like the 8486.
8486?
Sure, wow. Out into the marketplace. The microprocessors go in about 3 year cycles. And so here at this COMDEX, of course, we saw about 12 machines on the 8386. I'd say 3 years from now, you'll see the same thing based on the 8486.
You know, there were 462 vendors selling desktop publishing at COMDEX. I don't know if you're aware of that. Where's that going?
Well, like all these markets, a few vendors will do good products and things will get to be a lot simpler. I think to some degree it's there's, you know, a herd effect where people are jumping in. Desktop publishing, yes, it's a very large opportunity, but to some degree, word processors will have built-in capability that let you do a lot of documents. The idea of doing page layout will be important, but a number of users won't really need that capability, and they'll find their word processor will take care of it. You probably saw we introduced a new word processor for the Mac Word 3. That has a number of these things, and it's, you know, very easy to get at them when they're all in with the word processor. I do think that if you look in a company and see what types of memos people put out and what kind of information they have, and then you go and look 5 years from now, there will be a real difference in the quality of communication. It'll just be so easy to build in a little graph or a little table and make a much more effective memo than you can today.
There's a couple of key things you said. You said desktop, you said network, you said company. What happened to home computing?
Well, the original charter of Microsoft, which hasn't changed at all, is to have a computer in every home and on every desk. I generally hesitate to talk about the home because that's further out, and you know, people think I'm a little over-optimistic, but I absolutely believe it will be in every home. The challenge there is to come up with a machine that, in terms of educating or entertaining or providing information, actually is competitive with, you know, watching TV or reading books or getting the newspaper. And those media are very well developed. They're very, you know, inexpensive and portable, and it's going to take a new technology which allows the amount of storage of information on the PC to be, say, 100 times greater than it is today before I think we can really compete and do the job right. That's not to say that you won't see a lot of personal computing at home where people have IBM PC-type machines or Macs where they're able to take their work back and forth. But in terms of really being part of the home life and activity, it's going to take, compact disk ROM, CD-ROM-based machines with a whole new type of software that includes video and audio before you start to see the penetrations go into most of the homes.
You think, as you indicated, there'll be a new breed of computers for the home? Do you think there'll be a new set of manufacturers, or some of the existing manufacturers may turn that direction, like the Atari, the Commodore, and the Apple?
Well, I think the basic software we have around the IBM PC or MS-DOS standard is so strong that you'll want to carry that over into these machines even as you're adding this new storage. And so I think mostly it'll be the current manufacturers. The one addition to that is, though, that some of the pure consumer electronics manufacturers like Sony and Philips are very active in this area. In fact, the basic hardware technology was invented by Sony and Philips, and so I think you'll see offerings from them as well.
How much of an impact do you think the Japanese will have on the American market?
Well, a lot of the key technologies we use in personal computers, whether it's laser printers or LCD displays or plasma displays or advanced chip technology, are inventions that came from Japan. So they're already having a very, very strong impact, even though it's only a small percentage of the machines are actually manufactured in Japan. And I don't think we'll see that change. In fact, it's the Korean-based machines that are actually more price competitive than the ones out of Japan, particularly with the exchange rate doing what it's done. But I think you will continue to see a lot of the fundamental technical advances coming from Japan.
What do you think is the impact with this huge clone market? Because at the show, at least three of the halls were just filled with 286 clones, even 386 clones.
Well, I think it's great that end users have a lot of choices in those machines. You know, there's of course a range of these manufacturers. People like Compaq or DEC or HP, you know, are putting a lot more into the game than just their PC. But because the PC is so central, they have to participate in that. I mean, the PC has become the focus of computing. Some of those other manufacturers compete on the basis of price, and there's a lot of people going up, a lot of people going down. I think part of what's reflected there is it is very easy to get in and manufacture a PC. You don't have to build a huge factory or anything. The pieces can be picked up from a variety of sources. So I think it's a healthy trend, even though some of those companies won't do as well.
You've been viewed as a visionary in this field, and indeed you are. What do you think will happen about 10, 15 years from now, and how do you think it would affect culture the way we know it today?
The idea that we're in the information age, I think, is very correct. And putting information in electronic form so you can get at it very easily really changes how we learn and how a lot of businesses work. I think the idea that at your fingertips there will essentially be this world network of data that, even say sitting at home, you can call up information, whether it's, music or video you want to get at or the latest stock information or weather, is very fantastic. I also think that people underestimate what we can do with all the computing power we're going to have. As I say, the semiconductor industry isn't clearly can deliver magic at the same rate they have for the next 10 years. And that means that we'll be able to synthesize, whether it's flight simulation or, taking you someplace you're not, or putting actors that you like into the scene or synthesizing you into the scene. I mean, we will be able to create digital presentations, video and audio, that should change entertainment quite a bit. I mean, I think interactive entertainment will win out over passive entertainment. And I think the idea of sitting at work and finding out what's going on and making the right decisions for your company, that'll be a far different, you'll have a far different way of going about it when we have this world network of information and we make it easy to get at that data.
One of the things I found is that there's a generation gap in computing itself. Like, I have a 13-year-old, and there are many of those of the same age where they are very, very computer literate, and my wife is almost half the depth of the computer. How do we ever overcome that?
Well, that's a real problem. Computers today, to learn things like what's a file, what's a disk, and, what are these weird commands, you have to go through a period where you're really confused, and young people seem to be more willing to persevere when it's all confusing and get to the point where they form a model in the head of what all are these things, whereas older people, even though they're very, very capable, they kind of say, oh, I'm not made for computers. And certainly with the amount of computer usage in the schools, that just reinforces this situation. People coming out of college today, such a high percentage have used PCs and view that as the way you get things done. You know, there's a lot that can be done to improve this. We are making the machines easier to use. I think, you know, a lot of people are recognizing that they should make the effort to go and learn the machines. I put a little time in and got my parents using the machine, and now they're off on their own and, you know, enjoying it a great deal.
Is it possible that we may end up having a hammer effect? In other words, to put a nail into a board, you would use a hammer, and sometimes people use a hammer to put a screwdriver in the board, and sometimes people use a hammer to break the board in half, so that we may be so concentrated on the use of a personal computer as a universal tool that it may not really be a proper fit for what we should be using it for.
Well, because it's a general purpose device and you just put different software in, and the software industry is very, very competitive. I mean, I think if there's, you know, some different way they ought to be used, the industry will figure that out and come around to it.
Microsoft Windows is one of those products that makes it easier to use a personal computer. Do you think there will be more functional features, and maybe other authors will be looking at Microsoft Windows as a benchmark of how things should be built?
Well, we believe that Microsoft Windows will be a standard in the same way that MS-DOS is. That is, it'll be on over 90% of the PC-type machines. And that future applications eventually will all be built on top of that, because graphics interface is a lot better. And what you've seen is month by month we get, you know, additional applications, additional drivers, changing over the base standard from MS-DOS to be MS-DOS plus Windows takes a great deal of time. And I do think, though, that people in industry see that trend and are moving their future investments in the direction of Windows.
Do you think Windows will spawn a real growth in artificial intelligence?
Well, the graphic interface allows you to present information very nicely. So you can think of it as almost like the syntax, the presentation layer. We do need to also improve the layer below that, the semantic layer, and artificial intelligent techniques are the key to that. So in the sense that once we get graphics interface, we will have done as much as we can at just the presentation layer, and to make things really easier, like take a spreadsheet, to make it so you don't have to learn formulas and cells and, you know, dependencies and things like that. We're going to have to change the semantics of the software underneath. The techniques that come to us from the artificial intelligence community are the key to that. Really allowing the computer to learn the same way that a human assistant would, and letting you specify things with, you know, very, well, less precise but easily understood constructs.
What about issues of data security? Because as the personal computer becomes more readily available, it becomes more distributed, and information tends not to be as so tightly controlled.
Yeah, there's a lot of issues we're going to have to deal with. The fact is that today information is protected very nicely. You know, if you see some stranger going up to somebody else's desk and start rifling through the drawers, you're going to, you know, go up to them and say, "Hey, what's going on?" But the electronic equivalent of that isn't as noticeable, and this will become a very key issue. Even, you know, for electronic mail, you don't want everybody to read all the mail that's going around. I think we will come up with solutions, but there are going to be some people who are surprised that they haven't protected their data, and that's a real problem.
You brought up electronic mail. That's interesting, because today, in a corporate environment, you have deck mail and Wang mail, and they don't talk to each other, and we wish they were able to tap into each other. What about standards? How should we go about
setting or abiding by standards on an international basis with other countries and other organizations?
Well, there is certainly a lot of work going on in that area. In fact, the electronic mail one is a very good example to pick, because the work that's going on is very concrete and it's excellent work. It's under this so-called X.400 group that's a standard from the International Standards Organization, ISO. So I'm very optimistic in that particular case. We'll have a world standard and we'll get those things connected together. Not just so you can send mail, but also so you can look up names and use group names and make a very efficient interface to the mail system. Some of the other areas like document formats or networking standards, they haven't made as much progress, although there's some effort going on there. You get this complex interplay between people who want proprietary standards, between these open standards, and also you have the moving technology, and so it's sometimes bad to pin down a standard when there's going to be a better way of doing things to come along. And I do think, though, that all the manufacturers recognize the need for standards. And here in the United States, a number of them got together and formed what they call the Corporation for Open Systems. I think that body will help move this problem forward quite a bit.
What do you think the direction is going to be for robotics?
Well, the founder of Atari, Nolan Bushnell, is probably the most optimistic about this. He guarantees me that in 3 years, they'll have a robot go to my refrigerator and get a beer for me and bring it back to me. I think that's a little difficult. The problem isn't that motors cost a lot or that the physical body of the robot. Stepping motors are pretty cheap. These little laser devices that can detect distances are quite good. The tough thing is that the environment, whether it's the office or home environment, the environment you have as far as how you maneuver around and what you do when something surprises you really requires a lot of knowledge about what's going on. And humans are awfully good at a lot of things, and navigating around is definitely one of those. So I'm less optimistic that robots will have a big impact in at least the next 3 or 4 years.
What about the area of process control?
Well, certainly there, the idea of a robot is broader. Any sort of moving arm is a type of robot, and there it will have a significant impact. I mean, it already is having a major impact on a number of manufacturing tasks.
Let's move forward, if possible, in the next 20, 30 years. Do you think gallium arsenide ever get off the ground?
Well, we need... as I said, the semiconductor industry for the next 10 years, just using silicon, is going to be able to do chips that are twice as good every 2 years. Out at that point, you start to get a problem in terms of how large the atomic structures are, because they're just very few atoms thick. And it's possible that gallium arsenide will help us push that horizon out. There's a number of technologies that aren't mainstream today, like gallium arsenide, that are being explored so that when we get to limits of silicon, we won't have to stop. But none of those, I don't believe any of those will come into the mainstream for at least 7 or 8 years.
Talk about the mainstream. Microsoft seems to be in the mainstream of the personal computing industry from the beginning till now. Pulling this back a little, I read in the papers the other day that you are now the number one software company. You are the biggest, at least in revenues and also in profits. Are you on target?
Well, it's not such a concern to us who's number one. In fact, there's two other software companies, Lotus and Ashton Tate, that are about the same size. From quarter to quarter, one will be bigger, one will be smaller. That's not really how we measure ourselves. The key for us is that this vision we have making the PC better and getting it onto more and more desktops, that we really make progress on that. And we participate both at the system software level and the applications level. At the system software level, with MS-DOS and Windows and their evolutions, we play a very critical role in this industry. And even, you know, the other major software companies come to us and get the idea about what foundation they'll be building on. And so that's a role of great responsibility. It's also very exciting because it lets us really inaugurate a lot of new capabilities and really set a direction for the industry, for example, in the way that we're doing for CD-ROM.
Well, we're going to wrap this up, but might you have any final words for us?
Well, this Comdex, I think, is, although there were less surprising products here, it is a real milestone in that this Intel MS-DOS standard is showing, you know, incredible strength, where people are being innovative, whether it's with portables or 386 machines or a variety of ways the machines get used. And I think it's fantastic for users that there is this standard and all this choice out there.
Well, thank you very much, Bill, for taking the time out from your very busy schedule and to be able to share your insights with us.
Marty and his wife recently moved into a 40-year-old house in April, and he had carpenters, electricians, and AC crews, and landscape designers, plumbers, and townspeople. He had people from everywhere. But just because they do all the different kind of work, Marty sometimes, he gets hands-on too, and he's ready to talk about some of the different tools that he needed to complete some of the work that in the house. Marty?
My work life, well, it includes a lot of product reviews, hundreds every year. And those include a lot of tools from many brands, Rigid, Weller, Ryobi, Rockwell, Klein Tools, Works, Dremel, Milwaukee, Vicegrip, Wagner, and more. Many of my segments here involve a lot of work around a house, and that goes faster and gets easier thanks to some of these tools. So I thought today I'd share a little about the tools I choose and use and how they help. For example, I used to use canned air to clean out my computer and keyboard and trackball and so on. When the Hurricane canless air system came on, now these are cans that look like the ones that include the chemical stuff, but instead there's a rechargeable battery and a fan in the can, the usual nozzle tube about the top. Well, I went with Hurricane canless air systems for a while, and I still use them now and again. Then Ryobi came out with their benchtop blower, which is kind of a downsized version of a leaf blower. More power again, and a bigger blow. It's really cool seeing clouds of dust escape my PC when I blow it out through its fans. I've used the bench blower to clear pine needles or debris off the walk. It's that powerful, but the spotlight moment came for me when my carpenter used it instead of a broom to blow all the sawdust into one pile. Ryobi was there again with a battery-operated wet-dry vacuum. The total cleanup with those two tools, done many times faster than usual. I remember the first time I tried drilling into a cinder block wall to mount a shelf. It took forever, and I burned out a drill bit. That was a standard drill, probably a Black & Decker. I got my first hammer drill, bought the right kind of masonry bit for it, and it was like plunging a hot knife into butter, really done effortlessly and in seconds. Most of my drills and drivers since, from Rockwell, Ryobi, Rigid Works, Milwaukee, and more, have incorporated pulse or impact and or hammer modes. Surprisingly useful for loosening stubborn screws. I have these things in compact versions, right angle drivers, palm drivers, push triggered, trigger triggered, and even a switch run drill press. Well, two, if you count the small one from Dremel. Here's what I can tell you about drills and drivers. In fact, this advice applies to many kinds of power tools. First, I strongly prefer brushless motors in my tools. They provide both more torque and more runtime from the battery, and they also have a longer life expectancy. Second, I have some preference for cordless tools that are in a battery family I'm already using. I have batteries and chargers for Kobalt, Works, Rigid, Ryobi, and Rockwell, among others. When it comes to variety, Ryobi has the lead with, 100 or 200, more than 100, I know, the cordless tools on their 18-volt battery system. But there's some variety in every brand. And no, I don't know any easy way to adapt one brand's tools to work with another brand's batteries. That's how they keep you in the battery family, keep you buying their tools. Where electricity and signal wires are involved, I keep finding clever products from Klein Tools. Simpler ways to terminate and test cables, trace AC outlets back to their breakers, do non-contact AC power tests and measurements, fish cables through walls, see inside walls, and more. Their hand tools are also remarkable, from socket sets that put a range of sizes on one handle to strippers that handle ranges of wire sizes up to, I think the smallest I use them for is 32 gauge. They also have insulated and metric tools, coax fitting tools, and some of my favorite tool knives. Nothing of theirs, nothing from Klein Tools, has ever disappointed me. I think most of my drywall tools are either from Klein Tools or from Ryobi. There's a jab saw, a freehand rotary cutter, a screw gun, and some magnetic outlet locators, and a few other odds and ends too. Mycanic, spelled like mechanic but with the letter Y instead of the first E. Mycanic has a rolling work stool on wheels with a padded top, a tool rack in the back, magnetic wings for holding parts, and two slide-out drawers. It's a real back saver when I have to work close to the floor or when I can lift something off the floor, like my system unit, and rest it on the stool's cushion. It holds up to 300 pounds. I don't worry about it. Other tools? I have fans and compressors and heat guns and non-contact thermometers and laser levels and inflators and pressure washers and hammers and punches and socket sets and a bench grinder and compact cutters and saws. A lot of the same tools that most of you have. Some are a little different. My first pressure washer looked a little like a lawnmower. It was a Ryobi outdoor model on wheels with a hose connection, a long power cord, and a push handle. Pretty normal. I also got in later a Works pressure washer that uses a battery for power and lets me screw on a 2-liter bottle as its water source. And for most small jobs, that turns out to be the one that I reach for first. I also have some tools you might never think of getting because of my work with microelectronics. I have a pro-level Weller soldering and desoldering and rework station, a hot air soldering gun, an LCD microscope, tiny wire cutters, tiny pliers, drill bits down to almost hair diameter sizes, task lights, magnifiers, board holders, and bizarre tools to open cases that consumers are not supposed to be able to open. I have a 2-trace oscilloscope, a 4-trace oscilloscope, a bench power supply, a bench power source, and more digital multimeters than I can count. These days, some of those also measure frequency, duty cycle, capacitance, and more than just the traditional volts, ohms, and amps. I also have test gear to measure light intensity, sound intensity, airspeed, and the presence of volatile organic compounds. In my reviews, I never know what kind of claim I may encounter next, so I try to be prepared to test any that make me suspicious. I also review some defensive handgun products. And as a result, I have gunsmith-level hammers, punches, specialized screwdrivers, trigger pull scales, and a few ultrasonic cleaners. I have many kinds of specialized pliers for electrical and electronic uses, plus vice grips, and I confess, I just bought my first pipe wrench and my first chisel. I have socket sets, open-end wrenches, so-called universal wrenches, and a torque wrench. I also have bolt cutters, which my wife has somehow become convinced that I need to cut my toenails. Okay, yes, I have a lot of tools. In fact, I see more arriving in the next couple of days. Just got one in a few hours ago. So maybe one thing I should address is how to manage having so many. Well, first, I should explain, I don't keep them all. Simpler tools, for which I have more powerful or more advanced or more pro-level counterparts, well, those simpler ones get donated, some to schools, some to the usual charities. Some of the more specialized tools, like nailers, are new turf for me, so I provide them to seasoned pros in exchange for their veteran observations on what's good or bad about the new product. I tend to let the pros keep those. Among the stuff that's left, I try to think in terms of where I'm most likely to be when I'll need to use them. The test lab bench gets one cluster of tools, generally normal size to smaller, the things I might need to open or close all kinds of cases, poke around inside, take measurements, and that kind of thing. That bench is a gorgeous birch finish Sjoberg's bench with oscilloscopes and power sources on the left, soldering rework and an LCD microscope plus microelectronics tools on the right. The three drawers on the left hold the most demanded hand tools, and there are some special rigs that I keep in the cabinet under the bench. Out in the garage, I have a rough work workbench. Its shelves hold the power tools, or at least as many as I can fit, and the back of the bench is lined with chargers for the different kinds of tool batteries. I also have a mechanics-style rolling tool cart, you know, a metal box with stacks of metal drawers all on wheels. I've done two things with it that you may want to consider. One thing I've done is to take my little Epson LW400 label maker and label each drawer. Every contractor so far who has seen my labeled drawers has commented on it being a great idea that they want to do now. Who knew? The other, I invested in different kinds of drawer organizers. Trays and bins in some cases for things like screwdrivers, wired dividers in others for things like pliers, and in some cases, those plastic pop-top sandwich cases to hold things like specialized tool sets to fit the chucks of drivers to make it easier to work with things like, for example, screw hooks and wig nuts. My labels and dividers probably save me 20 minutes a week. Next time, I want to shed a little light on LEDs, on some of the ways you can tell their differences, and how I'm making some almost zero-based decisions about where and how I'm using them.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. The following are computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need for technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb question. All these computer club meetings are open free to the public. New York Amateur Computer Club has their general meeting on Thursday, June the 13th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at NYU Silver Building at 32 Waverly Place in Manhattan, New York. Long Island Macintosh Users Group has a meeting on Friday, June the 14th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at the Harry J. Scherr Hall, New York Institute of Technology, out in Old Westbury Campus, Old Westbury, New York. Princeton PC Users Group has a meeting on Tuesday, June the 25th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. And Brookdale Computer Users Group meets Thursday, June the 27th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet in the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room, 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. If you have a computer club meeting you want me to announce on the air, send me a note. My address is hank@pcradioshow.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm on the Internet. Podcasts of the programs available on prn.fm, on the Internet, and pcradioshow.org. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. There is no such thing as a stupid question. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.